You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All this week, we're going to focus on climate change and how it will affect us here in the state of Michigan. It is a huge crisis that faces our generation and generations to come. It'll affect every aspect of our lives, from what we eat to how we travel to how we live inside our homes. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton is here now to talk about the big picture for the state of Michigan. Tracy, let's just start at the very beginning. What is climate change and why is it happening?
So climate change describes what's happening to our environment as the planet's atmosphere is warming up. And that warming is happening because of an increase in greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, but also methane and some other gases. And those gases are almost all of them coming from us. Whenever we produce and burn a fossil fuel, including coal, natural gas, gasoline, diesel, propane, the like, and also from our clearing of the world's forests, which trap carbon dioxide.
And boy, we can see and feel that warming is happening already. I just got back from touring France with a group of Michigan Radio listeners. So we were there for the highest temperatures France had ever recorded. We had 104 degrees in the Loire Valley. So I certainly wasn't surprised at this new report that July was the hottest month in recorded history. So we know it's global, but it's going to look somewhat different based on where you live. Let's talk about Michigan. What's it going to look like in Michigan?
Well, it is going to make things hotter in Michigan, that's for sure, especially in the summer. And we had a taste of what is to come in mid-July. We had 3-4 days of nearly a 100-degree heat index. And that's the combination of heat and humidity that just feels incredibly oppressive. And it's dangerous, too. So imagine having that happen not just a handful of times a year, but up to 25 days a year. The Union of Concerned Scientists says if we do nothing to curtail our emissions, that's in our future by mid-century. And 26 to 50 days of those extreme heat waves a year by late century if we do nothing.
Well, we call it climate change now and not just global warming because the heat's going to do other things, right? Like here in Michigan, we're seeing an increase already in these intense and more frequent rainstorms and flooding.
Yeah, we have seen that. And we've seen an increase about 14% of precipitation in the Great Lakes region since 1951. That's expected to continue. But weather is harder to predict than the temperature increases. So it could be back and forth. We could have years of really dry, hot summers in Michigan with super wet springs. And we could have more lake effect snow in the winters. But as it continues to get warmer, we could have a lot more rain in the winter.
So this is an area where the science is not as settled as it is with temperature increases. What about our Great Lakes? Because we all remember 6 years ago, we had near record lows in some of the lakes. This year, everybody's talking about near record highs, which causes a lot of problems with erosion and people's homes flooding and marina owners really being hurt. Is more of that in our future?
The answer is probably. This is one of the biggest areas of uncertainty right now for Great Lakes climate scientists. Will we see more of this rapid shifting from low to high levels and back again? But the research is definitely leaning towards yes on that one.
What else might we see in the Great Lakes?
Oh, boy. It's a long and not very happy list. Maybe more E. coli contamination on beaches, more severe cyanobacterial blooms in the lakes, changes in our fish populations and forests. I guess there's one positive thing to mention, and that's that it's going to be so much worse in the south. It's so hot that people may actually have to move, and they may move here.
All right. So you mentioned a couple of times, Tracy, that this is if we do nothing. Let's talk first about what we can do to prepare for climate change and then what we can do to slow climate change, because some of it is coming no matter what we do, right?
That is right. So the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere right now, it remains there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So even if we stopped all fossil fuel burning and deforestation tomorrow, the planet is still going to warm up from the CO2 that we pumped into the atmosphere before. So you mentioned when you were in Paris, it was a terrible heat wave. But that city has an emergency plan that it developed after the last deadly heat wave in 2003. So they do things now like checking up on the most vulnerable people in the city, making sure they have ways to get cool. And They dramatically lowered heat deaths compared to that last heat wave. So our Michigan cities need to be doing things like that. They can go to the Red Cross, which just issued a comprehensive report on what steps to take. And because of that flooding, our cities also have to make changes to our infrastructure to deal with flood events.
All right, let's talk about what we can do, really what we can do to try to reduce carbon emissions and limit the impact of climate change. We can't all afford to immediately run out and buy an electric car and put solar panels on our roofs. And it's clearly a bigger problem than just individual behavior. So what could each of us do that has a bigger impact?
So I asked Richard Rood that exact question, what can we do? He teaches climate change problem solving at the University of Michigan, and his answer kind of surprised me. He tells his students to run for local office.
Start thinking about how to work within their homeowners associations, how to work within getting elected to city councils and school boards to start to have influence on local policy.
Yeah, he says these local and city and state policies, also regional multi-state efforts, could really move the needle on energy efficiency and renewable energy, public transportation, and reforestation. And, you know, these local and state and regional efforts are really crucial right now because the Trump administration is, in fact, rolling back policies that address climate change. I also asked this question of Margaretta Kearney. She's with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and she agrees with Rood. She says, get involved. If your city doesn't have a climate change plan, demand one. Or if there is one, but the city's not meeting its goals, hold your elected leaders accountable. She says, vote for people who promise to do something about climate change and hold them accountable. Hold corporations accountable.
We can force the people who represent us in government and the companies who sell things to us, we can insist that they change the way they are responding to climate change and that they take much more significant action. And that bigger system change, I think, is where there can be a real impact on carbon emissions.
And we have heard of businesses realizing it is smart business to be environmentally aware and to take kind of actions. And you've just gotten wind of an environmental initiative that Governor Whitmer is launching.
Yeah, last week she announced a plan to direct state departments to look at ways they can reduce their energy use and increase energy efficiency. And that includes an initiative over at our state prisons where they're going to be installing solar panels to make the prisons greener.
Well, we'll be talking a lot more about environmental issues and how people are responding with action all this week. Meantime, you can get lots of information and resources by going to MichiganRadio.org. Tracy Samuelton, always great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Depending on where and when you grew up, what you learned about climate change in school may vary.
I learned nothing about climate change in high school.
Climate change was always something that was at the forefront.
A little bit in my AP environmental class.
It really wasn't in the curriculum.
But in some Southeast Michigan classrooms, climate change is becoming a major part of what students learn. The Environment Report's Lauren Janes reports.
All right, good morning, everybody.
Jessica Kruger-Kopel teaches math at Ypsilanti Community High School. In one of Kruger-Kopel's Algebra 2 classes, between linear equations and reading graphs, students learn about climate resilience.
They really focus not on like the doom and gloom, but how can we be more resilient and how can we adapt and help our community be more prepared to handle the challenges?
The Detroit-based nonprofit EcoWorks sends Logan Appleby and Keem King from an outfit called the Youth Energy Squad to help teachers facilitate discussions on climate resilience. Here's Appleby.
Talking about problems in their community oftentimes is the driver that pulls in students who maybe aren't considered someone who engages in class. But we use our program as an opportunity to engage all the students.
Organizers say what makes this program work is that students identify issues and come up with solutions on their own. At the end of the school year, students create a community-based project to help fix a problem caused by climate change. Last year, projects included a rain garden and plant buffer strips, which help remove carbon from the atmosphere. And students seem to be excited. The class I sat in, Christian Green, raised his hand for almost every question. He's a senior at Ypsilanti Community High. Green says he likes the Youth Energy Squad, especially the hands-on activities. He says he likes the real-world applications for what he's learning.
To focus on the community and like what's going on around us in a fun way, but also an educational way. And to conserve and try to do better for each other. You know.
Funding for the program comes from a nearly $500,000 federal grant that the Southeast Michigan Stewardship Coalition distributes. So far, 9 schools, many of them low income, are benefiting from the grant. Kruger Kopel, the math teacher, says learning about climate resilience is especially important in schools with high poverty.
For students to be able to see that they could make an impact and have some change in high school, I think prepares them for outside of high school actually being advocates for their community and making change, which I think is a super important thing for students in high poverty situations to believe about themselves.
This Southeast Michigan program is one of 22 national climate change projects funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Sarah Schettinger is a program manager for NOAA. She says the action component is critical.
This is a problem that's going to require the energy of youth. By involving them in not only studying about the problem, but also thinking about how they can make their communities more resilient, actually can bring a sense of hope to what can seem like a pretty hopeless situation.
Young people today are living through an era that will only see more disruption because of climate change. Schettinger says learning about those threats and figuring out potential solutions is something that cannot wait. For the Environment Report, I'm Lauren Janes.
From Michigan Radio, this is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. We know that burning fossil fuels releases a lot of greenhouse gases, but there are other human-caused sources that contribute to climate change. One of them is how farmers plant crops. All agriculture accounts for 23% of human greenhouse gas emissions, according to the International Panel on Climate Change. We're going to look at a smaller but still significant portion of that.
When we think just about cropping systems, we're looking at somewhere on the order of 8 to 12% of total greenhouse gas loading. And 8 to 12% is a lot when we think about what we need to do to rein in greenhouse gases.
Phil Robertson is a Michigan State University professor who works at the Kellogg Biological Station near Battle Creek. When he says cropping systems, think row crops such as corn, wheat, soybeans. Conventional tilling, that is, plowing up the dirt, encourages microbial action. That can lead to CO2 emissions and the more potent greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide.
And so we end up with a lot more CO2 being emitted than we would in a natural system, for example, or in a system that's no-till.
That's why Michigan State University researchers have been studying no-till and similar techniques.
No-till is a way of farming without plowing the soil.
No-till can mitigate the greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change.
When it's time to plant the next crop, they'll use a planter that cuts a slit in the soil, and the seeds go into that slit, and the plants come up and are just as happy as when they're being put into plowed ground.
That keeps carbon in the soil. About 50% of corn, wheat, and soybeans are planted using no-till. Each year the soil is not plowed up, more carbon is stored. But it can all be lost. Let's say a farmer used no-till for 4 years. If that field is then conventionally plowed, that carbon stored over the years is released. Farmers say it's sometimes not practical to use no-till. They say they need to plow the field when it's too wet to plant. It can help dry things out.
I don't agree with that statement.
Blaine Baker is working on his combine at his family's farm in Lenawee County. He's been using no-till for 23 years in a row. He says there are years he's actually planting earlier than other farmers.
So, I mean, I'm not saying no-till is a cure-all for everything, but we planted days when other people weren't running, and we didn't hinder our yields.
He says the real barriers to no-till are these. First is the idea that this is the way we've always done it. Second is money.
There's costs associated with it, and especially when you're sitting there and you got the full line of other equipment to go out and do it like you've always done. What do you want to invest another, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 when I've got the equipment sitting there ready to go?
There is a third factor. Politics. Despite the preponderance of scientific evidence, climate change is still political. Some farmers simply dismiss climate change as fake science. Baker says there are other benefits from no-till. One is preventing the erosion of rich topsoil.
And particularly now that we've gone to cover crops, we've got something growing out there all the time. So our erosion is pretty much nil.
Despite the benefits, few farmers use no-till consistently. Baker says that's a shame.
Huge, huge amount of carbon that is sequestered, but every time you open it up, you're releasing it. So long term, you know, the environmental impact and all that, no-till is a smaller footprint.
A four-year survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows only about 20% of cropland was in no-till or similar techniques all 4 years of the survey. Until more farmers commit to using no-till every year, planting crops will continue to be a significant contributor to climate change. With the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Come on, Casey!
That's Siobhan Berry. She's cheering for her son, quarterback Casey Berry, at a recent varsity football game at Kalamazoo Central. Schools in West Michigan have been rescheduling a lot of outdoor sports these days to avoid dusk. That's when mosquitoes, possibly infected with Triple E, are most active.
This game started at 3. I don't get off work till 3:30, so I'm late. I know parents have been saying they wanted to work concession, but they have to rearrange work schedules to be able to volunteer at a kid's function. That's sad.
Here's why people are so worried. In about 4 to 5% of people infected with Triple E, the virus moves into the brain that either kills them or causes neurological damage, often permanent. There's no vaccine and no treatment other than support measures like IV fluids. The state of Michigan said it would offer aerial spraying of a pesticide to reduce mosquito populations. Barry says she'd be all for it.
If it's this bad to where you have to rearrange your life, then if it's necessary to spray, at least try it.
But Kalamazoo County will not be spraying, although other affected counties will. That's because 1,200 people and groups opted their properties out, including the Kalamazoo Nature Center. The center said spraying could harm bees and other insects, frogs and fish, and deprive migrating birds, which eat mosquitoes, of an important food source. For each opt-out, the plane has to skip a 22-acre zone around it. Jim Rutherford is the county's health officer.
From an aeronautical perspective, you can't just start and stop on a dime. When you're traveling, 175 miles an hour, 300 feet in the air, we calculated all of the opt-outs that, hey, there's just nowhere for us to treat.
Rutherford was surprised and disappointed by all the opt-outs. He's not in general a fan of spraying, but in this case he is. The spraying uses about an ounce per acre of pyrethrin pesticide, which is considered safe for humans and mammals. It's also unlikely to harm daytime active insects like bees. Rutherford wonders if the state should consider shrinking that 22-acre zone around opt-outs.
Basically, you're looking at 5% of the population making the decision for the entirety as a whole.
This likely won't be the last time Michigan has a bad Triple E summer. Climate change could make some seasons worse. Howard Russell is an entomologist at Michigan State University.
Ample rain and warm temperatures means there's going to be more mosquitoes.
And Michigan's swamps, bogs, and hardwood wetlands are a mosquito paradise, he says.
Michigan is blessed with, I think, 61 different species of mosquitoes. Our topography is perfect for mosquito development.
Russell says his house is surrounded by swampland. So what does an entomologist do when the mosquitoes are thick? Despite his love of insects,
I'm pretty careful with what I spray, but there are times of the year where I have to get out my backpack sprayer and I have to knock down the adults.
So far, 9 people have been sickened by Triple E in the state. 4 have died. Health officials say people should take precautions even if their county sprayed. That includes wearing long sleeves and long pants outside, especially at dusk, using insect repellent, repairing window screens, and dumping standing water in your yard where mosquitoes can breed. There is the usual relief on the way. Cold temperatures are in the forecast, and the first hard freeze will generally kill mosquitoes. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
This is the Environment Report for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Each year in Michigan, billions of gallons of raw or partially treated sewage end up in the rivers and eventually the Great Lakes. That pollution can make people sick. There are 2 causes. One is poor sewer systems. The second is climate change. We went to a city that's working to fix its part of the problem. The Grand River cuts through downtown Lansing. As kayaking and canoeing have become more popular, Rivertown Adventures went into business renting canoes and kayaks. But it has to close some days because of heavy rains. Paul Brogan owns the company. He says E. coli bacteria contamination from sewer overflows is a concern, But the high water and faster current are bigger concerns.
And for those two reasons specifically, just out of a safety factor, we don't put customers on the river. And those are the only times that you would really maybe see or maybe smell something different.
A lot of storm sewer outlet pipes flow into the river, and some of them are more problematic than others. I put my kayak in the water to see what I could find.
Okay, well, here we are on the launch ramp at Moores Park in Lansing, and we are now in the Grand River. We're going to head up to the Red Cedar, where there's supposed to be a large spot where the sewer comes in.
It wasn't hard to figure out one of the problems, a large outlet pipe on the Red Cedar River.
For the first time on this river trip, I'm actually smelling sewer. I can't see anything that would tell me, hey, this is what it is, but I can certainly smell it.
When the county health department warns about E. coli levels, the news media warn the public. But many people are confused about when it's safe or if it's ever safe to come into contact with river water. Jill and Blake Weston were kayaking in the same area as I was. We started talking about the smell and the public health risks.
Does it bother you? Because I've heard a couple of people talk about whether
it's... Well, if it's a problem, then yeah, I would not want to be paddling on it, obviously.
Didn't keep you from paddling today, and you weren't sure. Right?
Well, no, I had heard that it was, but with you being an environmental reporter, I didn't know if you would have any inside information on that.
The inside information, such as it is pretty simple. It's a river, it flows, it carries the E. coli problem downstream in just a few days. So is anybody doing anything to reduce the amount of sewage getting into the river? Andy Kilpatrick is Lansing's Director of Public Service. He says they've been working on this problem since 1992. It's caused by a sewer system that combines sanitary sewerage, the stuff you flush down the toilet, with stormwater runoff. That works when it's not storming.
But when we had rain events, then we had the road drainage plus the drainage from people's basements that would all go in that combined sewer. We would have raw or partially treated sewage that would overflow into our rivers here. And so that was the mandate initially to clean that up.
So the city of Lansing has been going from neighborhood to neighborhood, separating the sanitary sewer from the storm sewer. They've reduced combined sewer overflows by close to 50%. There's been a complication, though.
We're finding, I don't know if it is climate change or what, but more frequent rain events that are coming, and the intensity of those, that is what really causes a lot of these issues.
Scientific research says, yes, it is climate change. It's not that the annual rainfall is rising that much, at least not yet. It's that Michigan is seeing more heavy downpours, which swamp the sewer system. For Lansing, it's going to be another 15 years and a lot more money before sewage overflows into the rivers are completely stopped.
We're probably talking about, once we look at the entire program, you know, over $500 million, so $500 million we'll have spent by the end of this program just to take care of the combined sewer overflow issues.
80 municipalities across the state are dealing with combined sewer overflows. The problem is far from fixed. This is going on at the same time of a new trend in paddling. A lot more people are putting kayaks and canoes on the water. Paul Brogan with Rivertown Adventures says that's raising awareness of problems with these rivers.
Our waterways here are precious, and people want to experience them, and why not? So it's a true recreational resource now, and we've got to pay attention to keeping the waterways clean. And fixing these combined sewer overflow situations is a key, a big part to that.
But cities are dealing with uncertainty. Climate change computer models predict not only will we continue to see these intense rain events in the Great Lakes region, but annual precipitation could also increase. Cities don't know how to plan for that unknown or the costs. With the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
From Michigan Radio, this is the Environment Report. I'm Kay LaFond. Climate change is likely to bring more extreme rainfall and flooding to Michigan. So flood risk in the next 100 years will probably look very different than in the last. But much of our infrastructure, like culverts, bridges, and storm drains, is still being designed and built based on the floods of the past. There's this culvert in the southern part of the Huron-Manistee National Forest, and I went out to see it. I braved a busy highway and some really tall grass to get down there. The Michigan Department of Transportation built the culvert last year to replace an older, rusted-out model. It funnels a small creek underneath State Highway M20.
The
Not much happening. It's just kind of a trickle right now. It looks like it could hold a lot more water.
In fact, the culvert is big enough to handle a flow rate of 255 cubic feet per second. That's equal to about 2,000 gallons per second. So how did MDOT arrive at that size? Let me explain. When engineers build a culvert, bridge, or storm drain, they consider how long the structure is supposed to last and the largest flow it's likely to see in that time period. If they can, they look at decades of historical flow data. Ever hear of a 50-year flood? That's the flow that has a 2% chance of happening in any given year, meaning you'd expect to see it about once every 50 years. And it's calculated based on the flows of the past. If historical flow data isn't available, you can still estimate flow by looking at rainfall. For example, MDOT sized this particular culvert by using values from the 50-year rainstorm in the area. And the 50-year rainstorm is determined in much the same way as the 50-year flood, using historical data.
We're using our existing data sets and the existing information to calculate flow rate.
That's Kristen Schuster, an engineer with MDOT, confirming that her agency is not incorporating climate change when they size culverts, bridges, or storm drains. But climate scientists say we're probably in for more intense and frequent rainstorms and flooding in the Midwest. There's no guarantee the 50-year flood will stay the same size. And yet, we're still designing structures as if it will.
You know, we have not tackled that issue to determine if we need to change those numbers.
The Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, or DEGL, is responsible for calculating design flows on bigger watersheds. Susie Greiner is an environmental engineer there, and she says they aren't accounting for climate change in their calculations either.
We are not climate scientists. We are engineers, and what we have to work with is the data that exists now.
Michigan isn't alone here. There are also federal agencies involved with calculating design flows, and it's hard for states to update when the feds haven't. Gabriella Villarini is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa. He says there just isn't a good method yet.
How do we design now? How do we take into account these changes and now that the historical record is not necessarily representative of future conditions?
Villarini says it's difficult because long-term human-caused climate change isn't the only thing impacting flood flows. There are short-term climate cycles too, and changes to the landscape. Right now, he's working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to incorporate climate change projections into some of their designs. He says he feels a sense of urgency, but that this kind of research takes time.
It's a wide problem. It's a big problem. It's a recognized problem, but it's also not an easy one. And so it's one that we need to tackle with care.
Susie Greiner of DEGL wants to stress that even though they aren't including climate change in their flow calculations, the state requires structures to be designed on the large end, often to withstand the 100-year flood.
So even if you're getting more intense storms more frequently, the odds are good that you're still going to have built the structure to withstand those storms.
But climate change is likely to keep shifting the odds on storms, and infrastructure will need to keep up or risk being overwhelmed. For the Environment Report, I'm Kay LaFond.